Hello, I'm Rolf Fontenelle. This is the Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast, and you are listening to Oddcast episode, coming back for more part 3, Platonist Reincarnation. We've had a look at the roots of the idea of reincarnation in the West, as far as we're able to reconstruct them. This is a notion which we first see on the historical record among ancient Greeks, as far as the roots of the West goes. This is the notion, again, that human beings have something called a soul, a psyche, which can separate from the body, the soma, and upon death is going to enter into another body and repeat the cycle. This is a notion which was definitely around in the 6th century in various contexts, among the people generally discussed as Pythagoreans, in the cultic milieu known as Orphic or Bacchic, which the Pythagoreans had something to do with, but no one knows exactly what the relationship was, and in the cultural milieu which gave rise to the iatromantes, the healer seers, the Greek shamans, as they're sometimes called, who also first appear in our evidence from about the 6th century, but who probably have roots going back much further. The same is true of the mystery cults, like the Orphic, incidentally. They probably also have roots going back further. At any rate, we can add up all of this evidence, including the stray bits of evidence from people like the poet Pindar, to say that reincarnation was a belief that had some adherence among ancient Greeks, but was not anything like a majority belief, and was largely, possibly always, held among adherents of particular esoteric, cultic milieu. And we include the movement known as Pythagorean in that cultic milieu statement, because all our evidence for early Pythagoreanism is that it is a sort of cultic milieu. We can also say that in all of these cases, as far as we can tell, the cycle of reincarnation was viewed as just a fact of life at best, but something to escape from at worst, as among the Orphics. The whole point of Orphic initiation and underworld activity, as preserved in the Lamellae, was to escape from the cycle. Assuming that Bernabe and Cristobal and others are right, that there is a belief in reincarnation lying behind all the Orphic material. It might be that it was some Orphics had a reincarnation belief, some didn't. Anyway, if there were Orphics who had different models of death and what happens next, they're not really relevant to the present discussion anyway. The point I want to make is, again, that we have takes on reincarnation in this early material which just state it as a fact, and we have takes that see it as something to be escaped from. What we don't have any evidence for is Greek thinkers saying, don't worry about death, it's all going to be okay because you'll just be reborn. The prevailing opinion, thus, was that the cycle was at best neutral and at worst a trap to be escaped from it. There's no positive spin on reincarnation in any of our early material. We then turned to Plato and saw that he posited a number of different models of reincarnation as to the details, but that aside from this dialogue symposium, where the immortal soul sort of doesn't come into the dialogue, he's pretty consistent on a few points. Reincarnation happens, it's cyclical, and the cycles have something to do with astronomical cycles. It is unambiguously ethicized. The quality of your reincarnations depends on your actions in your present life, an idea which may have been present in earlier philosophic or cultic notions. There are hints of it in Empedocles, but which really only becomes unambiguous with Plato. And in Plato, there may be a way to escape from the cycle for especially virtuous people, namely philosophers. It's clear that Plato is drawing, as ever, on earlier ideas, notably the Pythagoreans, or some Pythagoreans, maybe Orphic ideas, but figuring out what in the material of Plato is Pythagorean, or Italic, or Orphic, and where we're just seeing Plato riffing and doing his thing, is a really tough nut to crack. That brings us to our present discussion. What the followers of Plato in later centuries, the Platonists, made of Plato's thoughts on reincarnation. There are a few things I want to discuss under the rubric of Platonism and reincarnation. First of all, we'll take a brief look at the early evolution of Plato's reincarnationist ideas in the Old Academy and into early Platonism, which arises in the Roman Empire of the first century or the late Republic, depending on what you want to consider Platonism in the full sense. Then we need to pull the focus back for a minute and discuss the degree to which reincarnation was a popular belief in the Greco-Roman world, or on the contrary, the degree to which it was confined to elite philosophical schools and the like. Then we'll turn to the philosophic school known as Platonism, not really a school, but a current of thought in the Roman Empire, and discuss reincarnation in that context, including some of the problems the Platonists argued about in making sense of reincarnation. And finally, we'll discuss the denouement, the end of polytheist Platonist teaching in late antiquity, and the role played by reincarnation in that story. So, reincarnation after Plato's death. So first of all, to set the historical stage, after Plato dies around the year 347 BCE, we have the period lasting through the 4th and into the 3rd centuries of what's called the Old or Early Academy. Speusippus, Xenocrates, Polemon, and Crates, the successors to Plato as scholarks of this thing called the Academy at Athens, which Plato had set up. Now, after these guys, Arkesilaos comes along and takes things in a new direction, and we have the rise of what's called the Skeptical Academy. These philosophers ran with the Socrates of questioning everything and doubting everything, rather than the Socrates of the forms and the immortal soul. So they aren't particularly relevant to our story, and we haven't covered them much in the podcast. However, we should stop and see if there's any evidence for a traditional teaching of reincarnation among Plato's earlier successors before the Skeptical Academy. Now, we don't have a lot of surviving evidence from these early successors, and this is one of the great puzzles of the history of ancient Platonic philosophy. See John Dillon's book, The Heirs of Plato, for a still excellent summary of what we do know about these thinkers. And unfortunately, we don't have evidence, as far as I can see, for belief or disbelief in cyclical reincarnation among these early heirs of Plato's philosophic legacy, except in one intriguing case, that of Heraclides of Pontus, a fascinating character of the early academic scene. Now, Heraclides was a contemporary of Plato's, studied with him, and seemingly later studied with Aristotle, who is another student of Plato's. And the details of his life are hazy, but some connection with Plato and his teaching institution is a safe bet. And Heraclides had some really interesting ideas about the soul and reincarnation, which we have to mention, especially as the other early academics just don't tell us much, right? Heraclides does argue that souls are immortal and that they reincarnate. And moreover, he continues the astral theme, which we saw in Plato's own work. When souls are not enclosed in bodies, they dwell in the Milky Way. This Milky Way idea will return among later Platonists as one of the main options for where in the night sky one might find the disincarnated souls. Now, Heraclides wrote a mostly lost work on the soul, which seems to have been a fairly standard philosophic treatise, and in which he seems to have argued for a quasi-material soul made of aether. So a soul made of star stuff, heavenly matter, an idea which will also return in a lot of later Platonism, but adapted, not applied to the soul, which is going to be utterly immaterial for all Platonists in theory, but especially for Plotinus and everyone after him. These guys went hard on the immateriality, incorporeality of the soul. But it will be applied to the soul's vehicle, as we shall see anon. But Heraclides also wrote a work which, if we still had it, would probably rank among the classics of the Western esoteric tradition. I refer, of course, to the On Things in Hades, or On Those in Hades, a work which featured a fictional, almost certainly, Iatromantis figure called Empedotimos of Syracuse. His name is probably meant to recall both Empedocles and Hermotimos, who are two historical examples of the healer seer, as we discussed two episodes ago. So when Empedotimus, this probably fictional Yatramontes, was having a siesta during a hunting expedition, we are told, his soul left his body and he traveled to Hades, where he spoke with Pluton and Persephone in person, and they seemingly revealed to him much lore about life and what comes after it in a series of visions. En autoptois theamasin. Incidentally, this information is recorded for us by the great Proclus, writing in the 5th century CE, which shows us that Heraclides' work was still being read as a source for afterlife lore very late in antiquity, and was held in some respect by at least one great Platonist sage. Indeed, Proclus records this as the record of Empedotimus' experience, as recorded by Heraclides, rather than as Heraclides' fictional account or whatever. So Heraclides is probably fictional. Yatromantis has entered the canon by late antiquity as a real person. Empedotimus is cited as an authority many times throughout antiquity, but it's not clear in people like Varro that he is taken as a historical character. By Proclus, he definitely is. Anyhow, aside from the mysterious and fascinating Heraclides, we don't know much about reincarnation in the first few centuries after Plato. That's the fact, and it's kind of a weird fact, but there it is. Let's fast forward. What will happen is that the Skeptical Academy will begin to give way to what we call Platonism in the first century BCE, a change often associated with one Antiochus of Ascalon, an eclectic philosopher who sort of steered the academic ship back from total skepticism towards something more dogmatic, drawing on lots of currents, including the works of Plato, the Stoics, and others. Antiochus, you can read about in the excellent work by Glücker. What happens after him is that we start to see philosophers who really are devoted to Plato treat Plato not as a kind of invitation to doubt everything, but as a philosopher with some actual doctrines, often ones which need teasing out from the dialogues using esoteric hermeneutics. These folks, readers of Plato, who treat him as a dogmatist and who see him as a foremost authority, are what are usually meant by Platonists. And we have talked about them in some detail in the podcast. And these folks, without exceptions in the surviving record, all believe in reincarnation. Now, before we get into our philosophic Platonists and their ideas about reincarnation, let's pull the focus back for a moment and look at Greco-Roman culture more generally, because I'm going to agree in what follows with the scholarly mainstream consensus and argue that belief in reincarnation among the Greco-Romans of the imperial period seems to have been largely confined to A, followers of esoteric cults, especially those known as mysteries, and B, Platonists, whether polytheist or in some cases Abrahamic. There are exceptions to this, such as certain groups of Christians. The Jews are a big question mark here. We'll get to those in later episodes. But in terms of Roman, Greco-Roman reincarnation, it seems to be confined to Platonists and members of minority cults, usually esoteric cults. So we need to ask the question, how do we know that reincarnation wasn't a more widespread idea among the Romans? Like, are we right in making it into such a kind of select and indeed largely esoteric belief outside of the Platonists, among whom belief in reincarnation isn't a particularly esoteric doctrine, but who are a self-selecting elite minority? So we have zero evidence for a belief in reincarnation among Romans of the pre-imperial period. I mean zero. The Romans did have a traditional cult, which, unlike the Greeks, very much emphasized family lineage. It wouldn't be too wrong to discuss traditional Roman belief, the cult of the Lares and the Penates, this sort of family cult, alongside traditional Chinese culture, for example, which is often described as ancestor-worshipping culture, somewhat sloppily. So there is a kind of ancestor worship thing in Roman culture, And there's certainly some continuity between the living and the dead in traditional Roman society. But there is zero cyclical reincarnation evidence. Now, from the late Republic onward, we start to see a few hints that reincarnation is on the Roman radar, but never in a just popular belief context, always in the context of Greek ideas transplanted into a Roman setting. The poets Ennius, who's the first Latin language epic poet, and later Virgil, both mention reincarnation in different contexts. But this is a literary setting. They're doing a Latin language attempt at what Homer did in Greek. So it's very difficult to gauge, what kind of belief system lies behind these literary depictions of reincarnation. What about normal folks? Well, in terms of Greco-Roman people, regular folks, by far our largest source of evidence for Roman ideas about the afterlife are the thousands of Roman tombstones and funerary inscriptions. Romans really loved funerary inscriptions. And the standard Roman belief about death, based on these inscriptions, was that you are born, then you die, and that's it. Yes, there are ghosts, and yes, ancestors are somehow still around in some ill-defined way, but no one reincarnates. There are thousands of funerary inscriptions which explicitly drive home the point that death is totally final. My favorite is the epitaph, which it has many attested versions in both Latin and Greek, but my favorite version is the Latin, non fui fui, memini, non sum, non curo. I was not, then I was. I remember, I am not, I don't care. Or, nothing matters to me, you might translate it as. Now, in the imperial era, a new ideology of post-mortem deification arose with regard to the emperors, right? They become gods after death. And we occasionally see a Roman tombstone or tomb inscription, which seems to indicate a belief in something like a post-mortem deification for regular folks. There's a whole book on this theme by one Vrede, if you want to check it out. But we don't see much to indicate belief in reincarnation, even on these tombstones. However, we do know that Orphic lamellae continue into the Roman period, which means the Orphic cult continues into the Roman period. And probably this means that there was a Greco-Roman Orphic cult which believed in reincarnation. And we can go further and say probably some other cults, some other mysteries held similar beliefs. In the main, however, our evidence pulls in the direction of the assumption. It's only an assumption, but it's an educated one. That your average Roman citizen, including the Greek speakers of the East, knew little or nothing of reincarnation as an idea. Or if they knew of it, they didn't believe in it. And those who did believe in it were Platonists and those known either to themselves or others as Pythagoreans and members of some cults. And this brings us to reincarnation among philosophic Platonists. Now, this following discussion isn't going to be a kind of complete survey of the beliefs about reincarnation that every Platonist held. I'm more just going to talk about some general themes and problems that Platonism as a whole had to deal with. For more on the individual beliefs of individual thinkers, check the episodes in the podcast on those thinkers. But I'll just say here that there is a lot more research needed on this. One of the things you find trying to find data about afterlife and reincarnation in the Platonists is that a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them treat it in a very cagey way. They either don't talk about it, which is a kind of glaring omission, or they talk about it in ways that leave it very open. And this is probably because death is just one of those things that's always a mystery. And so it makes sense to hedge your bets. At any rate, keeping in mind that more research here is needed, that there's not nearly enough scholarship on Platonist doctrines of reincarnation, let's see what we can say about it. As I said earlier, reincarnation is a doctrine which, as far as we can tell from surviving evidence, is universal among polytheist Platonists. We do have some Platonists who don't discuss the problem at all. so we just have to assume that they followed the majority opinion, but we don't have any Platonist on record saying, no, there actually isn't reincarnation, it's just not true. So it's a standard belief and maybe a defining belief of a Platonist. Certainly in later antiquity, as we shall see, it is going to become a mark for certain Christian intellectuals of all that is wrong with the Hellenes, the belief in reincarnation. And by Hellenes, especially as you get into later antiquity, what is often meant is Platonist intellectuals. Now, I'm not going to give a list here of all the places in which Platonist authors affirm and discuss reincarnation. For a nice collection of primary sources on the question, from Philo of Alexandria in the first century down to Olympiodorus in the sixth, see the notes to this episode where we cite a footnote from an article by Fortier, if I'm pronouncing his name right. Reincarnation, then, was a given among Platonists, and even highly Platonizing Abrahamic religionists like Philo of Alexandria, who it might be thought would have drawn the line at reincarnation, although, as we shall see next time, the relationship between Second Temple Jews and reincarnation isn't as simple as has sometimes been assumed. We might also add Clement of Alexandria to Fortier's list. Clement's is an early Christianity where, as we saw in episode 94 of the podcast, there is a progressive angelification process after death, which is reincarnation-esque at the least, but also uniquely Clementish, like all of his esoteric teachings. So more on that in coming episodes as well. But generally, this list of Fortier's is a list of Platonist philosophers, polytheists. So reincarnation is a standard Platonist teaching, but as with many other standard teachings of the Platonists, like the theory of forms, to take a classic example, while everyone would agree that it was correct, that it was the correct position, they would argue endlessly and open-endedly about the details. And this is the unavoidable result, I would argue, of taking a philosopher like Plato, who writes tricksterish dialogues rather than straightforward treatises, as a dogmatic authority. You're just going to end up with a lot of wrangling about what Plato really meant. So let's turn to some of the problems with reincarnation that Platonists argued about. By far the biggest problem was the issue of reincarnation into animal bodies, which is unambiguously there in the dialogues, but is expressed by Socrates with that little sprinkling of tongue-in-cheekness which accompanies so many of his pronouncements, such that you could ask, did Plato really mean this literally? Now, there are several reasons which immediately spring to mind why such a doctrine could be seen as problematic. First of all, if our reincarnations are determined along ethical lines, as they certainly are for Plato, well, what does it mean to be a virtuous pig or a dissolute horse, right? If you've become an animal, and the idea is that if you do better next time in your horse body, you're going to maybe reincarnate as a human again. Well, you know, what's the difference between a good horse and a bad horse in an ethical sense? Do animals have that kind of ethical valence to what they do, seeing as they don't exercise the sort of reason which enables humans to determine right and wrong action? So that's a big problem. The second main problem for Platonists was one of ontological categorization. The problem was that of ousia, essence, or particular sort of being. The human soul has an ousia, and this would surely be that of human soul, some Platonists would argue. So it could never be demoted to being an animal soul, because that's a different ousia. This latter problem was especially keen among followers of Iamblichus, for whom humans are humans and stay humans forever. There's no promotion or demotion on the scale of being for a Iamblichian Platonist. Now, if we refer back to Fortier's excellent article, he cites Damascius in his Phaedo commentary. For those who have forgotten, Damascius is one of the very last polytheist Platonist teachers, the last scholarch at Athens. And he considers, he does a retrospective consideration of the issue of animal reincarnation in the Platonist tradition up to him, and he identifies three positions among philosophers. The first is that the human soul becomes an integrating part of the animal in question, that a human can just be reincarnated as an animal. Now, we know that this was Plotinus's position. Soul, for Plotinus, is such a universal power containing within herself all possible logoi, that why shouldn't she be able to manifest, say, a horse? Okay, a horse is an irrational beast, but so what? Soul can do that, says Plotinus. Plus, a horse's higher noetic analog, the intelligible horse, the form of horse, is rational, or even hyper-rational. It's just the lower instantiation of horses, which are not. So these are some of Plotinus's arguments why humans can reincarnate as animals. And we are told by one Aeneas of Gaza, a late antique Christian writer, that Numenius of Apamea held the same opinion. So Plotty may have been following Numenius on this, as he did on so many issues. So that's the no animal reincarnation just really is a thing school. The second one identified by Damascus is that humans are only metaphorically assigned the form corresponding to their characters. So Plato is, you know, saying if you're going to reincarnate as a pig, what he means is, you know, you're a pig-like human. Again, Aeneas of Gaza tells us that Iamblichus was a proponent of this approach. And the Chaldean oracles, actually, fragment 160 de plus, which is cited by Proclus, is our earliest known explicit statement that humans definitely cannot reincarnate as animals from the Platonist tradition. So there is that tradition, that sort of Chaldean oracles, probably Iamblichus, going on to later authors. And Iamblichus seems to have saved the Platonic name for telling the truth by saying Plato just meant it metaphorically. This brings us to Damascius's third option, that reincarnation consists in an outward association with irrational animals. Now that is a bit obscure, but it seems to be a reference to the Proclean solution. Now, Proclus, interestingly, argues that there are indeed more and less virtuous animals. So he solves that first problem, the ethics problem. You can have a good pig and a bad pig. But while he goes whole hog on this piece of Platonic literalism, he is not comfortable with the other main problem with animal reincarnation, as many Platonists saw it, especially those following Iamblichus, namely that the boundaries between genera are really firm and human souls cannot slip into being something else. They have to be humans. Here, Proclus comes up with one of his famous subtle ontological distinctions, by which he is able to have his Platonic literalist cake while also eating the Iamblichian cake of inviolable, eternal ontological hierarchy. A human soul, when sufficiently animalized, becomes sort of like the daimon of an animal. As our guardian daimon is to us and its embodied humans, so our human soul becomes to an animal. It doesn't enter into the animal, but is in relation to it. Right? So Proclus kind of solves the problem just by making distinctions, as he often does. Anyhow, those are the three options as identified by Damascius. And to sum up a bit, we can say the following. We don't have enough information on the earlier Platonists, really, to say what stance they take on this animal issue. But Plotinus seems to have been the last important Platonist wholeheartedly to argue for animal reincarnation in the full sense. His student Porphyry equivocates, as he often does, and Iamblichus seems to have gone for the metaphorical approach. Sallustius, Proclus, and others seized upon this in relation to way of having animal reincarnation without really having animal reincarnation, thus preserving the human soul's ousia as a human soul qua human, while also respecting Plato's authority on the animal issue. That animal thing is really the biggest problem, I think, that Platonists had to kind of find a way around. But there's some other really interesting questions about Platonist reincarnation. And these ones are of interest to me, I hope to you, gentle listeners, but don't show up much in scholarship. So I think they're worth picking out because I think they're really interesting. A second big question, this does get some of a look in scholarship, is can you escape from the cycle? As we've seen, reincarnation in Plato is at least part the product of necessity, of the dread goddess Adrasteia, or of Ananke, literally necessity personified. And no one likes to be forced into things. Least of all, Platonists, who are aiming through their philosophical endeavors to escape precisely from the mundane realm of fate and enter into the freedom of the noetic reality. Thus, if you can escape from the cycle, you're going to want to. As we saw last time, Plato hints in a few different places at an escape, both in the downward direction, where incurable evildoers are going to end up in Tartarus forever, and in the upward direction, where souls of philosophers can exist without the body. But here again, there was much speculation and argument among Platonists. So there's three possible options. One is that you just don't talk about it, so there's a lot of Platonists who don't address this particular issue, and I can see why, it's a thorny one. Among those who do address this question of the human's fate after death, there is, on the one hand, Plotinus. Plotty is always rather cagey about afterlife stuff, but I think we can tease out a doctrine whereby, yes, the truly purified soul is simply going to dwell in the eternity of nous and never redescend. This is my interpretation, and it is not cut and dried in Plotinus's text, so I can't say that that's 100% what he thinks, but that's how I read him anyway. After all, the human soul is already in the eternity of nous for Plotinus. She just needs to stop it with all the sublunary activity, and boom, salvation is already there. Porphyry is on the fence, but then another option, again, probably Iamblichus, but definitely Proclus and everyone after him, posits an explicitly endless cycle of rebirths. The world is eternal, or not eternal, but endless, temporally endless in both directions, and so is human incarnation, over and over again, forever. Plato's passages where he suggests an end to the cycle are read by this tradition, which is probably a Iamblichian tradition, as referring to astronomical cycles. When Plato says forever, you can be free of the body forever, what he must mean is until the end of the great year or some other astronomical macro cycle. Now, the best place to find this version of the theory outlined in its mechanics is in Sallustius's On the Gods and the World, which we discussed in episode 170 of the podcast, and it's also supported by Proclus explicitly. So that's escape. What about where souls go between lives? Right? If you have cyclical reincarnation and there's a pause between lives, what are the souls doing in the meantime? This is an interesting one, which arises immediately when you attempt to take Plato's accounts as somehow having a doctrinal core. It's clear that reincarnation occurs cyclically for Plato. It's also clear that the cycles in question have something to do with the movements of the stars and planets, and we'll return to that astral question in a moment. And it's clear that there's more time spent between lives than in bodies. Plato gives the figure of 1,000 years in a few places, but this can be read and was read as a nice round figure rather than a specific number of years. But at any rate, what are the souls doing during this time? Well, again, a lot of Platonists avoid answering this question, and some scholarship has tried to draw a dichotomy between middle Platonist approaches, which tend toward the astral. The souls are in the Milky Way, as in Heraclides, and seemingly also in Numenius and Cronius, if Macrobius's reading of those authors is to be believed, versus a late Platonist approach, whereby the souls, being immaterial and incorporeal, are somewhere that is also in immaterial and incorporeal, namely the nous, the noetic realm, the world of forms. They follow Plato's hints that it is, in fact, the noetic world, which is our home between lives. However, I don't buy this middle versus late Platonist doctrinal split that you often see in scholarship. It does seem to be true that the question of how incorporeal souls could exist in something corporeal like the Milky Way, because they're incorporeal, so they can't actually exist anywhere in space or time at all. Well, this was indeed a problem for the late Platonists, who went so hard on incorporeality. It isn't fundamentally more of a problem than the problem of how souls can animate bodies in the first place, which everyone agrees they somehow do. So if you agree that the soul can somehow animate a body in some sense, then you might as well say, and it can somehow be in the Milky Way in some sense too, right? And in fact, we find a stellar side to the time spent between incarnations absolutely everywhere in later Platonism. it's just not emphasized very much for the most part. It's there in Plotinus, mostly not explicitly, but it's there. It's very much there in Porphyry, who really takes the whole stellar descent of the soul and ascent of the soul business quite literally, as we saw in episode 129 on his work on the Cave of the Nymphs. And while I don't know of Iamblichian evidence of this, Proclus, assiduous student of Iamblichus, and Macrobius, assiduous reader of Platonist astral lore, they both agree some or all souls, depending on who's writing, will dwell among the stars between lives, presumably going to their home star, as laid out in Plato's Timaeus. Probably the signs of Capricorn and Cancer are the gates of entry and exit into and out of the cosmos. Porphyry and Macrobius both support this idea, as does iconography from Mithraic temples, Mithraea, which might indicate a Platonizing tendency among Mithraists, but I reckon is more likely to indicate that the Platonists who supported this Capricorn-Cancer gates theory, which they obviously found a really good fit with the sort of heavenly gates in the myth of Ur in the Plato's Republic, they were, I think, probably just drawing on the same well of traditional astral lore as the Mithraists were also drawing, and giving it the philosophic stamp of approval. And Porphyry, in particular, loves to do this, give the philosophic stamp of approval to just sort of folklore. But we also can't rule out that Porphyry just got this doctrine specifically from the Mithraic cult, since he wrote on that very cult in a way which shows that he's definitely conversant with it and is most likely just initiated into it. That's the simplest explanation for how he knows so much about its mechanics. Now, is it possible for souls of an especially high rank or especially great level of purification to dwell in the noose between lives? This is another question that not all the Platonists answer, but seems to have been, it was definitely on the agenda of things to think about. And the answers that we do have from ancient Platonists sort of line up with philosophers' take on the soul's ontological status. So for Plotinus, unsurprisingly, whose soul is fundamentally rooted in the noetic, yes, that is indeed a possibility and constitutes a potentially permanent salvation through divinization. Porphyry, of course, equivocates, and for Iamblichus and the post-Iamblichian Platonists, the answer seems to be no. The gods are the gods, and they live in the nous, and humans are not the gods, so they don't live in the nous. Though, of course, through purification and theurgy, they can draw down the noetic rays into the mundane world, illuminating it. And so, interestingly, the idea that the Middle Platonist astral afterlife is typically Middle Platonism, while later Platonism doesn't have an astral aspect to eschatology, is really belied by the later Platonists following Iamblichus, because they all pretty much think the souls are going to be in the stars in some way between lives. It's kind of the only place they think the souls can be, although, of course, souls don't occupy a place in the way that objects do. Nevertheless, insofar as they have a place, it is somewhere in the heavens. And this brings us to another really interesting facet of this whole body of lore, which never gets the attention it needs in scholarship, namely the role of astrology in all this. Where things get interesting for those who love the science of astrology is how many later Platonists engage with the mechanics of astrology to explain precisely how the descent, the embodiment, and the reascent of souls works. Despite the important works of Dorian Greenbaum, Akinjinos Kanyamos, and some others, much more research is needed on this point. So the few brief remarks that follow are not attempting anything like a survey of all the evidence. I just want to point out the places at which Platonists were likely to bring astrological theories to bear on their theories of how reincarnation works. So the human character, your sort of personality, can be explained through astrology in the sense that the precise configuration of the stars which prevailed at the moment of your soul's descent, because the soul had to descend through that configuration, right, can influence your personality. And if the soul remains untouched by astral influences because she's impassible, well, her vehicle does not. So we're going to get to the soul vehicle next. Another potential place where astrology is significant is the notion of the home star as expressed in Plato's Timaeus, this could be and often was read as being an astrological notion in various ways. So when Platonists asked the question, what does he mean by a home star? They could look to astrology for the kind of technical answer to that. The allotted daimon, who oversees our mortal life, can be seen as being determined by astrological considerations, as with Porphyry and Iamblichus, and I think Proclus, though more research is urgently needed into Proclus's astrological beliefs. And when that monograph comes out, it will be a doozy, incidentally. There's also the notion of astral accretions, and this really does bring us to the role of the subtle bodies in theories of reincarnation. Many of the problems associated with reincarnation were solved by Platonists, especially later on, through recourse to the subtle body, which we discussed in episode 131 of the podcast. There's a whole dossier of lore associated with this entity. A human soul may have one subtle body, but more often has an indeterminate number of these bodies, or starry envelopes, or vestments, or pneuma bodies, or vehicles, you name it. The names for this thing vary a lot. Sometimes these bodies are explicitly granted by the planets, the planetary spheres, as in Macrobius. Our Mars body gives us martial qualities, our Venus body gives us generative tendencies, and so on. So you can see that the sort of pure soul, as it descends through the cosmic spheres, is granted layer by layer different pneuma bodies, which then will make it into what we recognize as an embodied human being, once you've added the final gross matter body that we can see and touch and so on. Other authors leave it more vague, while still assenting to the basic proposition that it is during the ascent that the soul acquires the subtle bodies, and that they're somehow acquired through the actions and configurations of the stellar bodies at the time of descent. Indeed, it's with the dawning of a subtle body or bodies that the soul really enters into time and space in the first place, which allows the Platonists to avoid all kinds of quandaries as to how this incorporeal, non-time and space-ish entity, the soul, can get involved in cyclical reincarnation in the first place. A lot of the problems raised by the theory of the incorporeal soul being incarnated at all are solved by the subtle body. Now, sometimes the whole ethicized aspect of Platonist reincarnation also plays out in the subtle body. So for Porphyry, as we saw in our episodes on him, since the soul is impassible, it can't really be changed by life on Earth. How would it be better or worse? How can you talk about, you know, sort of ethicized reincarnation, since the soul is just not subject to becoming worse? Well, the pneuma body, the pneuma vehicle, can become moist. And the more moist it becomes, the more it drags the soul down. Indeed, for Porphyry, the pneuma body is fully eschatological, because it not only kind of determines where you're going to go next, it also survives death and allows the gods to punish souls which have misbehaved. Because again, you can't punish an impassible soul, but you can punish its pneuma body, and the soul will sort of feel that in some non-essential way and be punished. The ritual purifications of theurgy are often spoke of as purifying the soul by later Platonists, but again, in a lot of places where the theurgic Platonists get technical, it becomes clear they're talking about purifying the subtle body rather than the soul. Because again, how would a soul become impure if it's impassible? Now, before we move on, there's a really great quote from Porphyry, a passage that shows how he integrates astrological theory, planetary influences, and a literal descent of the soul via her subtle bodies, which is Wilberding's translation of On What Is Up to Us. Quote, "The pathway of the first life takes place across the seven spheres, but each soul moves through these spheres in a different way according to their impulses towards certain second lives. And so this pathway doesn't make all souls devote themselves to the written lives in the same way." So your first life is the descent of the soul. Thus, the soul that has chosen the life of a dog immediately goes to this ascendant, technical astrological term there, while the soul that has chosen the life of a human being goes, by turning aside from that point, to this ascendant, again, using technical astrological language. So you can see how the souls in descending are sort of encountering the astrological arrangement prevailing at that moment. They have an element of choice because they've chosen to be a dog or a human, but they also have to deal with the sort of structure of the cosmos at that moment. And so the sort of necessity, the playing out of necessity, ananke or adrasteia, which we find in Plato, is for Porphyry explained through the mechanics of astrology. Anyway, there's much more that could be said about all of these problems, but I hope we've covered some of the kind of interesting questions and problems that the Platonists were playing with in their trying to come up with a theory of how reincarnation works. And as a final matter of discussion, I just want to talk about, getting back to the sort of social side of things, how the theory of reincarnation plays out in later antiquity. Fortier, in that article we've already cited a few times, says, quote, "After examining the teachings of metempsychosis in the Platonic tradition and its condemnation by the church fathers, I shall argue that the most plausible explanation of this incongruity is that metempsychosis was more for Olympiodorus than one Platonic teaching amongst others. It had become by his time the veritable badge of a Greek philosopher, a badge which he was evidently intent upon wearing," end of quote. So what Fortier is saying is that this had become the sort of signature belief, the signature doctrine that really marked you out as a Hellene stroke Platonist intellectual. Obviously, Hellene could just mean polytheist as well, but very often when you're looking at the polemics against reincarnation and against the Hellenes in early Christian church fathers, the heresiologists and so on, they increasingly, as antiquity goes by, they mean more and more their most acute intellectual opponents, who are the Platonists, the polytheist Platonists. Now, I think this is right. I think that Fortier is right in pointing out that this was kind of a very much a signature belief of Platonism stroke Pythagoreanism in late antiquity, and that it was definitely one of the things that many Christian church fathers were against. However, he leaves a few things out which I think are worth pointing out. First of all, as we shall see next time, and in several subsequent episodes, the Jews had some belief in reincarnation going on. We don't know how far back, but certainly in the late Second Temple period. And that is something that is, the evidence is very troubling and confusing and difficult to interpret, but it's real evidence, and there is at least some Jews who believe in reincarnation. And I'm not talking about Philo of Alexandria, who certainly does, but just rank and file Pharisaic Jews may have, at least some of them, maintained a doctrine of reincarnation. But that doesn't refute what he's saying. However, what does refute, or at least nuance what he's saying, call for more nuance, is the fact that the Christian intellectuals, the heresiologists and such, whose work survived, are those who were selected and curated by what would eventually become this thing known as Orthodoxy. However, as we know, when people like Origen of Alexandria, certainly Clement in the second century, but Origen in the third century, Didymus the Blind, when these people were writing up through the fourth, fifth centuries, even in the sixth century, Justinian feels the need to call yet another council to condemn what he calls Origenism, which is probably more Evagrianism, which is still around in Christianity. Many of these Christians seem to have at least left the door open for belief in reincarnation. So where Fortier says that it's a sort of unanimous and signature belief among polytheist Platonists that human souls cyclically reincarnate, he is right. But the other side of the coin, that it's a sort of unanimous position among Christian intellectuals that souls don't reincarnate cyclically in this period, that's not true. We know that's not true, and we'll talk about early Christian reincarnationism in all its glory in a coming episode. Until then, be like the doctrine of reincarnation among the Jews of the Hellenistic and Roman worlds, which we're going to discuss next time, and stay esoteric.